From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Texting while driving is one of the country's most dangerous and deadly activities. We talk with one Milwaukee woman who hopes the story of her son's injury at the hands of a texting driver spurs change. Then safe driving in the winter calls for awareness and some easily available equipment.
And it was fascinating and revealing how quickly you could stop and how easily you could start with the snow tires.
SAS Bruce Campbell gets lost in the maze of an automated phone system, and a new project called Islands of Milwaukee hopes to connect people throughout the city.
It's not only trying to get people who are isolated. It's trying to set up an infrastructure for bringing meaningful engagement to people living alone. They might not feel isolated necessarily, but they want to participate in something.
Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. Texting while driving is a growing danger on our roads, even though Wisconsin has had distracted driving laws in effect since December of 2010. Governor Scott Walker proclaimed September 2013 as Don't Text and Drive Awareness Month, and a national campaign went viral then, too. You may have seen the commercials or the documentary they're based on, From One Second to the Next, directed by acclaimed documentarian Werner Herzog.
The lady who hit X was texting. Her head was in her lap. She never even saw X in front of her. She actually came straight through the stop sign. There were no brake marks, no skid marks at all.
That's Milwaukee mother Valletta Bradford speaking in the documentary. Her son, 8-year-old Xavier Davis Bilbo, a.k.a. X, was struck by a driver who was texting 3 years ago last October. X sounds like a normal third grader.
Hi, I go to Ginsling and I like to play games. I like to do art. I like to go outside to the park and I like to go out places.
But his life is anything but normal now. Mom Bradford sat down with Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce in their home in September and told her family story, starting with a day that X was injured.
It was a normal day. It was 70 degrees in Milwaukee on an October day. There wasn't a kid in the neighborhood inside the house, and how could I do that to mine as well? So I allowed them to go to the park across the street, and Ari, my daughter at that time, was 13. She said, well, we're going to go pick my friend up who lives on the other side of the playground, and then we're going to go out and play. I'm like, okay, fine. Of course, they've done it 1,000 times before across the street. She's 13, he's 5, almost taller than her at that time, and they crossed the street on our side of the playground, no problem. They crossed the street on the other side of the playground, going to her friend's house, and on the other side of the playground, a woman blew the stop sign, four-way stop sign, in a school zone, blew up that sign, and her head was in her lap texting. So she hit X on the wrong side of the street and drug him back to the side of the street where he started from, about 40, 50 feet away. There's no brake marks, nothing that she even stopped at all.
What happened to Xavier?
When she hit X, she paralyzed him. She dissipated a part of his spinal cord. So she missed his brainstem, they say, by maybe a quarter of an inch, if not even that much. He is paralyzed from the diaphragm down. As you see, he's trach vented, so he is on life support. They did everything they could to try to make those nerves work, but the lung just doesn't do it on its own. Still has the use of his hands, but his hands have some dysplasia, so they're kind of closed, but not closed all the way. So he eats with his hands, his arms still move. He's pretty active mentally, cognitively. We still have all of X here. He goes to school with the nurses, and X is pretty smart. He's above a lot of third graders in his class. He's actually in a class that's actually third and fourth graders, which is kind of it's a college preparatory class already in the third and fourth grade. So, you know, boy, has time changed since we were in elementary school. So cognitively, he is above and surpassing. And he got hit not even a month all the way into K-5. So it took us that first year to play catch up again. The 2 years from after that have been going a lot better, a lot better. And we just continue to try to keep the use of the hands, to keep the motor skills strong. You know, there's a lot of finger exercises that we do several times a day. I make him stop doing whatever he's doing and flex his fingers, press his hands against the other hands, everything to keep him, to keep that, what we have, to keep what we have.
Does Xavier remember the accident? Does he understand what happened to him?
He does now. He still has nightmares at times, you know. He, when he woke up from his coma and he was kind of really, when by the time that he got really coherent, he was very questioning, you know, why did she hit me? You know, I crossed the street the way you taught me to. I had my scooter on my shoulder. I was holding Ari's hand. Why did she hit me? And as a matter of fact, his scooter pretty much saved his life. His scooter, even though she did as much damage as she did, the scooter caught a huge amount of the blow.
He easily could have been killed.
Yes, easily. And the docs say also that his size and his height also saved him, because the grill from the truck, were whatever hit first, if he would have been the size of an average five-year-old, X is pretty tall, as you can see, if he was the height of an average five-year-old, he probably would have been decapitated.
Do you know what the driver was texting when she hit X and Ari?
I'm told that the text is, I'm on my way. You know, I'm asked the question often. You know, I'm asked, do you know what they were texting? Do you know what was said? I don't know why that becomes important to people, but it's burnt in our memory, you know, from the time that we were told that that's what she was doing. We actually found out at the accident scene that that's what she was doing. We had no idea. We thought maybe she just didn't see him, you know, and a family member, boyfriend, significant other, or something of that such came to the accident site and was screaming and yelling, I know that's what you were doing, and you're doing it all the time. I'm always telling you, and now, look, you've probably killed these people's baby. And, you know, it was a horrific scene. It was, you know, we're on the ground with X, family members, paramedics, you know, my cousin who was at the accident scene lives a couple of doors down. She's got Ari, and she's screaming, and my father and my brother showed up, and of course, they're losing it. So now the police are there, and the paramedics and the fire department, and me just trying to close out everybody except for X is down on my knees, on my belly, talking to him. Mama's right here, and he, at that time, he had been unconscious twice, you know, and them trying to be extremely careful in getting him together, to move him, to get him to Children's Hospital. Immediately, they pulled us into an imaging room, a consultation room, and sat us down, and I've got a medical background, and I'm looking at the films, and when they showed me the MRI, the first thing that I said, and I didn't mean to blurt it out like I did, but the thing that I said out loud was, oh my gosh, you might as well have killed him.
What happened to the driver?
My understanding is that there were two citations issued, one of them being because the vehicle was not registered to that person's name, and the other being something about a moving violation, but the tickets came out to like $170, $179, something like that. And there was no texting law in Wisconsin at that time yet.
So that's it? It was a $100-some-odd fine?
That's it.
What do you make of that? What does that say to you?
It infuriates me a little bit more. and it makes me struggle harder to do what it is that I do. It keeps me more on my toes about the educating part. It makes me understand that, you know, somewhere in Congress, somebody has to be listening. Somebody has to be paying attention that my five-year-old's life is worth $179. And that whether that person knows it or not, that person is part of our daily lives.
Have you heard from the driver since the accident?
The night of, and not again since. And at this point, I'm going to say we don't want to, because I don't see taking him through that. I mean, that person's had 3 years in October.
When Wisconsin finally did get a texting and driving law, what did that mean to you?
I was happy, but I needed to know that those laws were going to be enforced. I've pulled up next to cops and saw them texting, so, you know, I need to know that the law is going to be enforced.
How did your family come to be part of this It Can Wait campaign, including this recent documentary by Werner Herzog?
Well, I initially, 2 years ago, I said, you know, something has got to change about all of this. Something has got to stop. We initially did a visual kind of thing the first year after X got hurt at the scene of the accident. The second year, we did the X-Men event, which we do right here on 10th Street for awareness and education. We'll be doing the same rally again this year as well. And then I started by guest speaking at my daughter's driver's ed class. And then I started speaking at other high schools because the other driver's ed teachers were inviting me. And it just went from there. And then AT&T heard about me, and initially they had called me to ask me for information to the driver, because they were going a different way. And I said, I have no clue. And the young lady from AT&T, he said, who was doing the recruiting for the film, I guess, said, well, can I talk to you? And she had watched the DOT documentary that we did a few months after X was home. And she said, you know, can I just talk to you? And I said, sure. I talked to her. And she said, I'm going to talk to Werner. I think we need to change our minds on which way we're going with this. Then Werner talked to me. And then he said, she's right. And then it just kind of, it happened really fast. Like in a week, it went boom, boom, boom. And I'm like, whoa. This was like, okay, I'm making a movie with a real director, and I love film. So it was like, whoa for me, you know, like, Werner Herzog, whoa. So just glad to meet him, and he was compassionate, and he understood where we came from, and he understood what we're going through, and he understood my efforts and what I'm trying to do.
This sounds like it's been a long journey for you since the accident, advocating for texting and driving laws. What did you draw upon to be able to get out there and get this message out to the community?
Well, you're talking to me. You can tell that it's anger. Anger has driven me from one part of this to from one step to the next step to the next step. I mean, I'm not some lady driving down the street screaming irate, hey, stop texting on your phone, you meathead. You know, I'm driving down the street and I'm thinking to myself every time I see someone texting and still driving after all of the work that we're doing, after all of our efforts, how can they still be doing this? You know, and that just encourages me to keep going and keep up the fight and keep up the struggle.
Were you surprised when the documentary went viral?
Shocked. And I'll say it to you like that. I mean, it's well over 2.3 million hits on YouTube right now. And I thought to myself, when I saw 100,000, I was like, whoa. I'm like, 2.2 million? Right.
Why do you think this documentary struck a chord with so many people?
I don't know if it's guilt on some folks' behalf, because, oh my God, that's me all day, you know, texting while their, like, head is in their lap, and, you know, and they're getting in that last text or whatever, or this happened to a family member or a friend or someone of that nature.
Do you think this could be the start of a turning point in the national conversation about texting and driving?
Well, I have to tell you that this morning I went on my way to breakfast. I saw 6 people texting, at least 7 or 8 people dialing and then talking on their phones. That was only a 10-minute ride. So I don't know about things changing. I don't know about things changing for, but we get a lot of positive feedback. And I'm hoping that those people who give us feedback are saying, okay, listen, I guess I'm not going to do this no more. And then they'll tell 2 friends and so on and so on and so on. And I'm hoping that that's what happens with us here. I'm hoping that 2 people say, okay, I'm not going to text and drive no more. And then get in the passenger seat with a friend. And the friend whips out the phone and is like, I'm not going to ride with you if that's what you're going to do. And I need it to happen that way, because I feel like then that wave will get stronger and stronger and stronger. And then maybe we'll have a tsunami of people who are not texting and driving anymore.
What do you think needs to happen in terms of legislation and also in terms of the consequences of texting and driving?
First of all, I'd like to have everybody in the House watch the film. Every freshman class of the House should have to be required to see it. And then maybe those states that don't have the law will get the law, because then they'll see that this is just, it's absurd. It's ridiculous that you know, the same exact way that they changed the laws with the no drinking and driving, I think that they should all just get together, spend that extra $20 on the drawing board, and get it done. I'd love to have a good half an hour with the House. You know, I mean, I think that maybe I could change at least 40 minds.
What do you hope for X going forward?
That he becomes and remains a productive kid and gets to enjoy the rest of childhood. That we have him for a long time. That the injuries don't take over his body.
Well, Valetta Bradford, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Milwaukee mother Valetta Bradford and her 8-year-old son Xavier are featured in the documentary From 1 Second to the Next, directed by Werner Herzog. It's part of the It Can Wait campaign against texting and driving. It has over 2 million hits on YouTube. Valetta and Xavier spoke with Stephanie Lecce from their Milwaukee home, and we first aired their conversation in September. Well, even if you don't text and drive, which you shouldn't, the winter's ice, snow, and cold should still make you more cautious on the roads. Tips for safer winter driving are coming up next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. It may not be the polar vortex of a few weeks ago, but our second major cold snap of the season has descended upon us. The cold, combined with additional snow every few days, it seems, makes it not only irritating to drive, but also a challenge to keep our cars ready to cope with a double whammy of extreme cold and icy roads. Lake Effect's Dan Harmon is joined by automotive contributor Mark Savage to talk about a few winter car topics, starting with snow tires.
Well, I think a lot of people probably don't go with snow tires as much as they used to when we had a lot of rear drive cars, and it's probably not quite as necessary. But with a winter like we're having this year, it would be a good thing to have. And I will say this, 2 things. One is I drove a car recently that had Bridgestone Blizzaks on it, and this was one of my test cars, and it was absolutely awesome to drive in the winter because – it was a stick and I could put the power down and away we went, and I never ever had any problems with traction. And, you know, I'm sure the Bridgestone people are happy to hear that. But saying that, in addition, It's probably been 15 years now since Bridgestone had us out to the Pettit Ice Center with some cars inside. And, you know, they'd rented the space for the day and put us on the ice with normal tires and with other competitors' tires and their tires. And it was fascinating and revealing how quickly you could stop and how easily you could start with the snow tires. And snow tires are generally designed to work best in 45 degrees or cooler, and we've certainly had plenty of cooler weather this year.
No problem there.
No.
Well, what is different about these tires that allows them to function so much better?
Well, snow tires generally have more sipes, which is the little cuts you see in the tread, and that helps give it more traction in wet conditions and on icy roads, and that's basically the trick here is getting enough of the tire to get enough grip on the pavement that you either can stop quicker or start quicker. And I know a couple of friends of mine who use them all the time and have snow tires, and you know they wouldn't be without them in the wintertime. I just think most people don't want to spend the extra money to go ahead and go that route, and I guess you have to decide how much you're out driving and how proficient you feel you are behind the wheel.
Yeah, the other thing is being in an urban area where the roads generally get pretty clear just because we pay for that. I would imagine if you spend more time in rural areas that it might be worth the money more so.
It would make a lot more sense. You're right. In my neighborhood, frequently the streets stay kind of icy and snowy because you know there's not that much plowing or that much salt that gets put down. So it's a little tough for maybe two or three blocks till I get to a main road. But most of the time here, you know, we get out on a main street after – 12 hours after snow or whatever, and away you go, it's not a big deal. But certainly if you live in a rural area or you drive in from the country, you know, to commute into the city before you get to the highway or something, they do their job. I mean, you can persuade yourself one way or the other as far as the cost goes, but these are fantastic tires for the wintertime. I mean, they do a great job. There's, different compounds that they put into these things, different rubber compounds than they used to, and they do the job.
All right. Well, I used to live somewhere where studded tires are still allowed, as far as I know, and chains, and that's more of a mountain road thing
mountains,
to do.
Mountains, you still do that someplace.
We don't have any of that here, do we?
No. In fact, studs have been out for quite a while, and I don't know how many states even at this point allow studs, but just, right, it's more likely out in the mountain states and the Rockies and so forth where you'll see chains allowed. And studs. And, they do their job too. I mean, obviously I'm in the snowmobile world too, and we put studs into our sled tracks too because, hey, it helps you stop a little quicker.
Well, we're talking about some winter things. Seems appropriate right now. What about – I've seen actually a few articles that touched this issue about whether or not you should warm up your car. What do you think about that?
Well, there's two matters of practicality when – it's cold outside, especially when it's this zero and sub-zero temperatures, is in the olden days when we didn't have direct injection engines and better engines like we have these days, you needed to warm things up to get the fluids going and so forth. Now they say I think up to about 10 seconds and your oil should have already circulated throughout the engine and everything's fine. So most of us, that's if you start your car by the time you put on your seatbelt and if you have to adjust a mirror or do anything, put your gloves on, take your gloves off. That's your 10 seconds or 15 seconds and away you go. So it's not necessary to warm it up. But from a practical standpoint of, hey, it's zero outside and my car has been sitting out all night and it's cold inside, many of us probably would like to have them warm up for, a minute or two and get going. But at that point, you're wasting gas and you can argue certainly that you're letting more pollutants into the atmosphere and so forth. But I guess most of us probably, if we leave the cars outside, you start it, you scrape the windows if that's necessary, and a minute or two later you're driving down the street.
This is something where I've actually deferred to my owner's manual. I did go and check, and it very specifically states do not let the car warm up. Just start it and then drive away gently, it says, until the car starts to warm up.
Right, and that's it. It's obviously, the really cold temperatures, it makes everything brittle and everything's a little bit stressed. So when you start your car, like I said, give it the 5 or 10 or 15 seconds while you're sitting in the drive getting ready to go, pull on out, and then you know, don't try and race to the corner and go crazy with it, because everything is working to get up to operating temperatures and so forth. So as they say, drive gently. I mean, your brakes are going to be cold and they might be snowy or whatever too. So, you know, brake gradually and mildly. Don't go, you know, ballistic on your car. Give it a little break. It's cold like you are, and pull out gently, drive gently, and after 2 or 3 minutes down the road, things are going to start heating up and get to operating temperatures.
This makes me wonder how many cars that have the remote start are contradicting their manufacturer's recommendations to not warm up the car.
That could well be. But again, I think a lot of those is that you want to start it up, and if you have heated seats or a heated steering wheel, you want to turn that on and get it cranked up. And it's a comfort thing more than it is a car functionality thing.
So something that's block heaters, I don't really hear much about that anymore. Is that something that's still advisable or even helpful?
You know, you don't hear a lot about that anymore. I know some automakers still offer, you know, a little option package, maybe $50 or $100 to do that. It's certainly a viable alternative. And if you live especially in rural areas and your car is outside a lot, I know a lot of guys, for practical matters, do it for their pickup trucks and especially diesels, and put something in to help keep the oil and the block warm. So yeah, those still work, and it comes down to whether you feel you need that. If your car's inside or in a garage, that really does offer an awful lot of protection. I frequently, because I have these test cars and I don't have a big enough garage to get everything in there, I'll leave them sit outside, and you know, they start, and some crank a little harder than others when you first start them in the morning. But of late, when it's been really cold, my neighbor has been letting me stick the car into her garage, and you know, I've been checking the temperature gauge. So if I start it on a 0 degree morning outside, the car's at zero. And when I start it in the garage and let it sit there for a minute and look at the temperature gauge, it's usually 18 to 20 degrees. So 18 to 20 degree difference is a big difference when you're down in that zero and sub-zero range.
Okay. And engine block heaters can be aftermarket. Some manufacturers still let you – and they're really not that much money. I found them to be – pretty reasonable if you want to get one aftermarket.
Right. I think you're right. These are not high-cost items, and if it's something you can – especially if you have a garage and you have a place to plug it in easily, you know, why not? Give it a shot, and you know, if nothing else, the car will start easier, and there's got to be a little less stress on the engine just because that oil is already, you know, at a fairly reasonable temperature.
All right. And they're not just for diesels.
No, not just for diesels. No, they're for anybody who – feels they need that in their car. And like I say, if you're outside, leaving your car outside a lot, that's a real good thing to have.
Yeah. Actually, I was walking around and I saw someone's plug coming across the street into their car. And I was thinking, is that an electric car, or do they just have an engine block heater? I don't know. I didn't figure it out.
Well, yeah. Electric cars are a little tough in this time too, because, boy, their range drops way off with the cold, because cold zaps the energy.
Right. Well, one other big concern in this kind of weather where it's just snowing all the time and salting all the time is, of course, your car's paint. I think underbodies have come so far that it's not that big of a worry if you don't wash the underbody until winter's over. But the paint itself, what do you think? Should you wash it frequently?
Well,
there's no time. How do you even do it when it's cold?
I think when we have the weather like we've had lately where it just stays cold, it's not advisable to start putting more water on your car and freezing your locks and everything, your hood shut so you can't get into it if need be. But, you know, it's not bad to knock the salt off the car once a winter anyway and get it back down to ground zero. But we do have better paints. They're much thicker. They're much more elastic than paints used to be, so that they're not as brittle and they won't break because things have been on them for the winter and the cold won't affect them that much. And the cars all have the galvanized steel. Some now are adding aluminum, as we've probably all heard that Ford's going to add a lot of aluminum to its pickup truck. But some have aluminum hoods and so forth, and all that is much – well, aluminum's not going to rust at all. And the galvanized steel, it certainly takes a long time. I mean, think about it. When you see cars these days, my wife's driving a 12 or 13-year-old vehicle at this point, and it's just starting to get a little rust on the back wheel well. And it used to be after 4 or 5 years you would see that. So it's the cars are much better than they used to be, and you shouldn't have to worry about that so much.
Two questions follow-ups to that, which are, is it a fallacy, or maybe that's too strong of a word, that once you get below perhaps 20 degrees that salt won't have any effect on your paint anyway because it's too cold. Do you think that's true or not? And then does it matter if it's salt or calcium chloride?
Well, I'm sure the chemicals that are out on the roads and what all, you know, what mixtures they're putting out there can have an impact. I don't know what temperature that takes place at. I mean, I know some of these things are rated so that they'll melt down to like 15 or 20 below zero. So you would think if they're active and that they would be working on the ice that's on the street, that it's also going to be acting on the body of your car. But again, I mean, we all do run through a variety of things, and it doesn't seem to have that big of an impact. It's nice to get it washed off. It certainly looks better. It's nice to have clean windows because you can see better out of them. So all those are pluses. And just one other thing I would add, you know, for winter driving, two things is be sure to, you know, check your tire pressures occasionally because those can get low and you're either going to get worse gas mileage and or you'll have less traction. So kind of check those from time to time, especially after you've had a couple of real cold spells like this. And then the other thing that I guess I would just warn all the people who have four-wheel drive out there to remember that four-wheel drive is really mainly intended for mud and snow that is a couple inches deep, that where it gives you a lot more traction that way. It doesn't give you a lot of extra traction on ice. On ice, you're pretty well in the same boat as the rest of us. It's just that you may have a little more confidence that it's not going to be a problem and that it very likely will be.
And, of course, it might get you up to speed faster, but it won't slow you down any bit.
Correct. Yeah. And especially if you maybe have an older vehicle and don't have the anti-lock brakes, although most people have that now. But, yeah, just be careful out there. Everybody slow down, take a little more time. It's no big deal. What's another 5 minutes out in the cold?
Oh, we can handle it.
Right.
All right. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks.
Lake Effect contributor Mark Savage is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's auto writer and associate publisher for four magazines at Waukesha's Kalbach Publishing, American Snowmobiler, Classic Toy Trains, Fine Scale Modeler, and Scale Auto Magazine. He spoke with Dan Harmon. Getting lost in the maze of an automated answering service is a fact of modern life. Well, Lake Effect SES Bruce Campbell rages against the machine when Lake Effect continues next on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Automated telephone answering systems were supposed to help firms conduct their business more efficiently and to help those calling get to the right person faster. But for Lake Effect SES Dr. Bruce Campbell, they have not lived up to their promise.
I don't know about you, but my phone rarely connects directly with a living person. More often, after two rings, a pre-recorded voice greets me. If I am standing, I sit. If I am sitting, I lean back. If I'm leaning back, well, you get the picture. For example, I call. Hello, and thank you for calling Dr. Bob's office. Actually, this phrase is acceptable. It's reassuring to know I reached the correct number, and whenever I visit Dr. Bob, I have a good experience. I really like Dr. Bob and his staff, and having the recording offer some thanks for my call is courteous, but not really necessary. Knowing how kind Dr. Bob is, though, I do find the message charming. Our regular business hours are 8 to 4:30, Monday through Friday. This is useful information, but only had I been calling Dr. Bob to find out when there might be someone available to answer the phone. I check my watch. It's 10 a.m. Oh, no. Why doesn't Dr. Bob answer? Is someone hurt? Is there some sort of hostage crisis? Is everyone all right? If you are hearing this message during our normal business hours, it just means we can't get to the phone right now. Oh, thank goodness. If you know your party's extension, you can enter it at any time. So why does Dr. Bob refer to people who work in his office as parties? And when did people and parties become interchangeable? Is that proper usage of the term? Are there broader societal implications at play here? Please be assured we will take your call in the order in which it was received. This is heartening. An egalitarian approach to the seemingly trivial task of phone triage strikes me as a small moment of justice in an otherwise disordered and embittered world. If someone extremely important called immediately after I did, the president perhaps, or maybe one of the popes, I have now been reassured that Dr. Bob will take my call first. But I think to myself, why do they consume precious time telling me this? Is it perhaps not really true? Might they be pre-screening the incoming phone numbers? Dr. Bob must be able to see my name on the caller ID. He knows I am his patient. I half expect a bored voice to click on the line and say, Dr. Bob's office, we know who you are, please hold, and then click off again. I make a note to check the entertainment websites this afternoon to see if Dr. Bob spent the morning caring for Beyonce. Please stay on the line because our menu options have recently changed. Now I start getting restless. Is this message part of a nefarious plot to force me to sit in one place for an extended period of time? Perhaps Dr. Bob is actually a front for a terrorist organization, and he uses these messages to get targets to sit still long enough for enemy snipers to train high-powered rifles on them. Why else would Dr. Bob try to force me to listen to the entire menu when I heard the exact same message 2 years ago? What's he up to? I creep along the wall and carefully close the blinds. If this is a medical emergency, please hang up and dial 911. Now I am insulted. How stupid does Dr. Bob think I am? Hey, Dr. Bob, I'm bleeding to death here. Got any quick advice? Can you squeeze me in today and sew my arm back on? I sure hope you're taking these calls in the order in which they were received. I am starting to dislike Dr. Bob. If you have a rotary phone, please stay on the line. A rotary phone? Is he kidding? Come on, Dr. Bob. Who has a rotary phone anymore? Terrorists, perhaps? My kids have never even seen a rotary phone. And what if it's an emergency? Am I supposed to both hang up and dial 911 on my rotary phone while my arm is hanging from its socket? While I'm bleeding to death? Otherwise, you can leave a message after the tone and we will get back to you at our earliest convenience. You will call me at your earliest convenience? That's probably true, but is it wise to tell me that? I can't stand you, Dr. Bob. A very long pause and then a beep. I grip the phone, grit my teeth, and record my message. I suspect, though, that the reason for my call has long since healed, ruptured, or metastasized. I hang up, shaken and exhausted. Tomorrow, I will call Dr. Bob's office again and see if he can help me understand why I am so stressed and why I no longer have any time to get things done.
Lake Effect SAS Dr. Bruce Campbell is a head and neck cancer surgeon at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He also blogs at Reflections in a Head Mirror. He read his essay, Please Stay on the Line. We'll take one last break and then learn about a far-reaching project that hopes to connect people all around Milwaukee. We'll take a visit to the islands of Milwaukee when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Starting this week, Lake Effect will be airing the results of a remarkable effort to connect people, especially senior citizens, around Milwaukee. The Islands of Milwaukee is designed to reach and engage seniors, especially those living at home and on their own. It's spearheaded by Ann Basting, who studies and teaches both theater and aging at UW-Milwaukee, and also by the Sojourn Theater, with whom Basting collaborated on a recent acting project that engaged seniors at an assistant living center in Wauwatosa. We'll hear the first installment in the Islands of Milwaukee series in just a few minutes. But first, Lake Effect's Mitch Teich is joined in the studio by Ann Basting and via Skype from California by Sojourn Theater's Maureen Towey. Towey explains how the project evolved and why it's called the Islands of Milwaukee.
Ann and I worked on a project about 2 years ago in Milwaukee called the Penelope Project, or Finding Penelope, where we staged an adaptation of The Odyssey in a retirement community in Wauwatosa called Luther Manor. And that project used creative engagement in a care setting and was very collaborative with a wide array of older adults and staff members in that retirement community. It was really successful, and we were really excited about what we had figured out. And after we finished, we both said, well, could these strategies and tactics for creative engagement also work for older people who are living in their homes, who are aging in place? And that was really where the idea for Islands of Milwaukee was born, was us trying to figure that out.
And I think it was especially hit home because we were talking about how to replicate the Penelope Project and how do we share all these incredible things that came out of it, and documentary film, website, a book is coming out of it. But when we sat down, we realized the vast majority of older adults are living at home, and more than ever before in history, they're living alone. And what's our plan? There's no infrastructure like there is in a community care setting, like a congregate care setting, where people are responsible for providing social programming. And a lot of times people can dip pretty easily into social isolation. And some major organizations, you know, AARP and a couple others, have really identified social isolation as one of the biggest challenges facing the aging population in years to come.
So you might have started with a similar idea in mind to the Penelope Project, but then you're overlaying this issue of isolation onto it.
I think, too, it's not only trying to get people who are isolated or categorizing people as isolated. It's trying to set up an infrastructure for bringing meaningful engagement to people living alone. They might not feel isolated necessarily, but they want to participate in something. And it's creating that system that can be an ongoing, sustainable system after our participation in it in this first tier of setting it up is done.
Well, and so then let me ask the very obvious question. These are people who are often living alone and in disparate locations around the Milwaukee area. How do you reach them?
We have a great community partner network. So one of the first things we did was try to identify the organizations that were already successfully reaching these folks. And we sort of jumped in on the systems that they already had built. So we're working with – and what's the – you can list all the organizations.
The Milwaukee County Department on Aging, of course, and they collaborate with Goodwill Industries on bringing home-delivered meals. So people who and that's income-based. So it's determined who needs and who would benefit from having a meal delivered. We actually, in this pilot period, picked two dispatch centers that we're working very closely with, the Beulah Britton and Clinton Rose. We're also working with the fantastic Interfaith Programs for Older Adults. They do a whole range of programs from talking with folks on the phone to companionship to bringing people rides to the doctor and things like that. So we're really integrated into their systems for bringing creative engagement out through any of their programs. The other partner is Stoll Associates. We really wanted to see if we could figure out how to bring creative engagement into the care planning and caregiving systems. And Stoll opened their doors to that, and they're really working with us to figuring out how to integrate it into care planning.
Well, and so before you jump in, Maureen, let me ask you, Penelope was about this very collaborative project. You know, the people were all in the same place and they were working towards a common goal. How do you see the question of the day that you're bringing to people and hoping to have people participate in becoming a collaborative? You know, what about it is collaborative? How is it how does it achieve similar aims?
Well, the question of the day is the simplest invitation that we could come up with in order to get people to engage. And it allowed us to access a really wide array of people. You know, we send out these questions regularly. People can call in their answers to our island's voicemail line, or they can write their answer on a card, which goes back through the systems, which comes back to us. And the great thing about it is that, for example, we had one gentleman who we asked, how does water move? Show us how water moves. And his answer to that question ended up being a dance that he made. And then we learned the dance. And then we returned to his home and danced it for his wife in his garden. So it's this snowball effect where a tiny bit of participation could seed a really big art-making process. And all people need to do to start is to give us an answer to a question.
We're also trying to connect answers together so that if one person answers in one way, we can share that answer with another person who can then maybe turn it into artwork in a new way so that we're linking people in that way. We're also building toward using all of these answers eventually toward really catalyzing a community-wide conversation about the importance of staying connected to community as we age. And how can we as Milwaukeeans in the greater Milwaukee area keep our eye on that? And what do we need to do with and for each other to keep ourselves connected as we age?
Is the internet playing this kind of role as well, or do you find that the people that you are working with are still being left behind by the way that the internet seeks to connect us?
I think the internet is a partial answer. I think that we want to, just like with Penelope, we wanted to strive toward the greatest potential accessibility. So we're really trying to make everything accessible by phone. That's our least common denominator. That's where we can all meet, whether, you know, you're needs-based or not. The questions of the day can be – you can get them from our islands line on the phone, and you can return the answer that way as well. And then we do have a website where you can answer the questions and get the questions. We have a Facebook page. You know, we're operating on those levels too, but we want to make sure that people who either can't use a computer or who don't have access to computer or broadband, which is also another important component, that you can still do this and that it's still accessible.
And I guess the question I was driving at is, you know, to some degree, the kinds of conversations that you're starting with these questions of the day are often the kinds of questions that maybe a younger generation is already having in its own way via Facebook or Twitter. And this almost sounds in a way like social networking at its most basic level.
Yeah, it kind of is. I mean, if we were doing this project with teenagers, and we were crowdsourcing answers, we would just pop it out on Facebook and get back 1,000 answers. But when you're trying to reach folks who might be a little bit more isolated or might not use a computer or the internet regularly, it's a slower, more involved process. But I think in the end, the rewards end up being a little bit greater. And also, you know, a lot of what we do, it has to be sort of the cards have to be handed off. Like it really has to be a face-to-face interaction that start these things. Though the web is certainly, we're excited for the answers that are coming in on the web as well. But for the folks that are at home, it's crowdsourcing for our older people in Milwaukee.
And I have to say one of my favorite parts of the project so far, since we've been piloting these questions of the day over the last several months, has been seeing those handwritten cards come back from the home-delivered mm-hmm. meal drivers. And they're just lovely. I mean, people are almost creating art out of them, decorating them, and handwriting, which we don't see a lot of anymore, is a real treasure to me.
For the people who participate in this, how do you see it benefiting their lives? What would you see as a little victory for someone who fills out a card or makes that phone call?
Really, what we're doing with these questions is recruiting collaborators. We want people to be involved. We want their input in creative and civic dialogue in this Milwaukee. And I think that type of input and seeing that type of input put to use artistically can be really rewarding. And we're going to have a culminating exhibit at City Hall in September. We have you guys as a partner so that their voices can actually be heard in a new way. And I think, you know, we're able to shine a light on people's point of view and interests and hopes. That is a great thing.
I also think the way we're trying to come up with the questions of the day is thought-provoking, just seeing your day in a new light and to be listened to and to know that you're being listened to. I think there's, in an ongoing way, a great potential to have questions targeted toward this group and really to tell them your creativity matters and your input matters.
And a lot of our questions are also in the present tense. It's about, you know, embracing the day and the moment that you're in and seeing what imaginatively might come out of that, as opposed to constantly seeking what did you do, who were you. You know, we're trying to embrace now.
We're about to hear the first installment in this series, but do you want to share some examples of what makes a good question? Or do we not want to give anything away?
Well, we have our theme, the islands of Milwaukee. And so some of the questions will be tapping slightly into that kind of loose maritime theme, which acknowledges that we are separate and that we can end up being separate from each other, but that that's also okay. Sometimes that's out of choice. There's no value judgment in Islands of Milwaukee. We've been talking about it being more connected to the toward encouraging currents between the islands and a flow between them. So sometimes you'll hear questions that emerge out of that theme.
Well, let's hear the first one. But before we do, let me just say, Anne, Maureen, thanks so much. And we'll check in again as this project moves forward.
Sounds great.
Thanks for having us.
The Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towie from the Islands of Milwaukee. We've developed something that is very simple, that simplest level of invitation to engage. It's called the question of the day. Here's our first one.
If you could go anywhere in Milwaukee right now, where would you go?
People called in their answers to our Islands line. A lot of people wanted to go out to dinner. Some of their dining ambitions were lofty, others more modest.
Go to McDonald's, a restaurant on the South 6th and West Oklahoma Avenue. Have a couple of hamburgers and a cup of coffee or two, and then go home.
I would go out to have dinner, especially at Golden Corral.
There's a Red Lobster on the south side that serves crab. I've had a yen for crab. So I'd like to go there if it is wheelchair accessible.
We also got a lot of replies in person and through the question of the day cards that have been circulating through our community partner network.
I'd probably stay at home because I have an oxygen supply needed.
And if you didn't have the oxygen, where would you go?
Oh, boy. I would go deer hunting if I had a chance to go, but I can't go with this thing.
I would like to go to the art museum. They've got so much to see that I have not been able to, and I would just love to.
Do you know an older person, a neighbor, family member, friend, who is living alone or might be underconnected to community? You could be an envoy to the Islands of Milwaukee. Call the Islands line to get the question of the day and call us back with the answer. Help us create a more connected Milwaukee with one simple phrase. I have a question of the day. Would you like to hear it?
That was our first installment of the Islands of Milwaukee. Before that, Mitch Teich spoke with Anne Basting and Maureen Towie about the project. To learn more or to answer the question of the day, you can call 414-678-1563 or visit islandsofmilwaukee.org. That's 414-618-1563 or islandsofmilwaukee, all one word, .org. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air's coming your way next. Stay tuned.